Hello and welcome to this special edition of the Faber Podcast, featuring Steve Sem Sandberg, the author of the international bestseller, The Emperor of Lies. Steve was born in Oslo, and after a journalistic career spent mainly in Central and Eastern Europe, now lives in Vienna. Steve has achieved international acclaim for his detailed, vivid, and profoundly affecting portrait of the ghetto in the Polish city of Łódź, in Emperor of Lies. Sebastian Barry called the book monumental. Carmen Khalil compared his achievement in bringing a whole society to life to Dickens. No less a historical novelist than Hilary Mantel said of it, "Fiction here is operating at its best, to close the gap between past and present, between them and us, not through sentiment, but through real understanding. I find it difficult to think of any book that has had such an immediate and profound impact on me." What made the Łódź ghetto different from the others set up by the Nazis? Well, it was presided over by a complex monster, Mordecai Chaim Rumkowski, who compelled his fellow Jews to work for the German war machine, in a terrible pact with the devil that would ultimately cost hundreds of thousands of lives. The Łódź ghetto became Rumkowski's private fiefdom, with its own police force, shops and schools, even its own currency and chronicles. As you'll hear, Steve Sem Sandberg has drawn on those chronicles in order to reimagine the ghetto, even today still haunted by ghosts, and shine light on the nature of evil manifested in one particularly dark time and place. When we met earlier this month at the Faber offices, I began by asking Steve about making the transition from being a journalist to writing novels.
I was not a journalist instead of being a novelist. I was a journalist because you have to make your bread somehow. And in Sweden, it's the case that you have to earn some money. I started in journalism, and there's something about it that I enjoy, or I used to enjoy. It's like the feeling that you're in the middle of the world. Everything is actually happening in real time, and you have to deal with that in some way. You have to present it to an audience. You have to, really be true to events, and that taught me a lot as a writer, I think. I used to be, when I was younger, a little bit highbrow, very much into the theories of fiction, And you can get so many theories of fiction into yourself, but then you slam into the world of reality and you have to deal with things. I happened to be at the newspaper at a very good time. This was at a period of the time of the fall of the wall, when the Berlin Wall went down. And also later I went traveled a lot and from Yugoslavia, I went to Srebrenica, and all those places, and it made an impression on me as a writer. I think it was very good for me. I got to put my hands on real stuff, and I think that also for The Emperor of Lies, this has been it's a tacit experience. It's not nothing that you will read in the book, but it kind of formed me as a writer in many ways.
And the kind of fiction you write is very much grounded in documentary reality, isn't it? That's clearly a part of what nourishes your fiction.
I'm hesitant of using the terms I normally use in Britain, the words docu fiction or docu novel or something like that. Because for me, to my eyes, my books are purely fiction. But as a fiction writer, or if you're a European fiction writer, you know that you can use many different tools in order to achieve something that you want to achieve as a fiction writer. And using documentary material for me is one tool. You can use many other tools, and I've used them also in my novel, but the fact is there is a backbone of reality in my book, and I tend to think about it also as a backbone. It gives the general chronology, the basic events, but I really do quote from the Ghetto Chronicle. I'm making a direct quote only two times in a book of close to 700 pages. So all the rest is it's not made up entirely, but it's fiction. It's basically fiction. You follow 12 or 13 families going through all these events and to the bitter end, so to speak. And these common people are not in any recorded documents. There's people that I've imagined.
So how did you begin to approach this subject? Do you remember what your starting point was?
Yes, I very much do. I used to live in Prague at that time, in the Czech Republic. and from Prague, many, many Jews were actually deported to, which, for some strange reason, is very, very far off. Actually, there were five transports and total 5,000 Jews that left in 1941. And I was, at that time, working part-time journalism, part-time, full-time writing, to put it that way. So one thing I wanted to do was to follow in the tracks from Prague to which some of the people I knew had been deported. And some of them would maybe surprise British readers. Two of them were the elder sisters of Franz Kafka. As you know, Franz Kafka, the writer, he died in the early 20s. But his sisters, older sisters, lived on and got their huge families. And all of them were deported to the ghetto, which I never encountered anywhere in the literature of Kafka. The address or where they went, they just kind of disappeared into history like so many other people did, Jews did. So I followed them on the tracks and I actually found out where they lived, which I thought was something of a journalistic feat at the time. But I also was completely entranced by the ghetto, the city of Łódź itself. And what I hadn't imagined was that the ghetto area in itself would be so intact. It's basically today, to this day, still the same place as it was 65 years ago at that time. It's completely run down, shunned, decrepit buildings. And you could just go in empty stairways, and you could also walk into rooms that were just the same way as it had been during the war. And it was not even windows, window frames, just bare plates of wood or some textile to keep the rain out. And it was such a haunting place because I remember it was November, I was walking around in the streets, you know, when you don't know where you are and you kind of drop down into place and the only thing I had was a map. And the only thing that marked the ghetto area, the former ghetto area from the Polish city of Łódź, the other parts of the city of Łódź, was a kind of chalk line on the pavement. And I lost the chalk line. I was moving around so much, I lost the sight of this chalk line. And I didn't know where I was. Was I inside the ghetto proper, or was I being outside? And the place really haunted me. And for years to come, when I wrote the book, I turned to wherever I was living, either in Prague or in Stockholm or Vienna. I put myself back on the train and I went back there. And that was the largest, so to speak, inspiration for me to actually be in the place.
And that is something which other ghettos, which have been destroyed, wouldn't have offered you. But I also wondered how much the figure of Rumkowski was an impetus to write this book, how much that was a decisive factor. Maybe you can say a little bit about him.
I knew Rumkowski, of course, as anybody would, before I went to Łódź. And I was completely amazed that single man could have this kind of responsibility put into his hands. I mean, he was really the master of life in that town. He had the destiny of a quarter of a million Jews in his hands. And he could do and did with them whatever he wanted. So, I mean, it was a man who, but then again, this power was put into his hands by the Germans. You shouldn't forget that. I mean, it was the Germans who actually made him do this. But since all his speeches had survived, I read them during my first day in which actually I was amazed the way he talked about the ghetto as his nation state almost. Like, and he talked about when he addressed the people, he said, "You can go to my bank to change your money. You should go to my pharmacy. You should go to my shops." Like everything and everyone belonged to him. It soon became clear to me that this was not some sort of simple rhetoric the way he addressed people, but he actually believed this. So when he says that you have to amputate the legs and the arms of the ghetto in order to save the Jewish people there, he was actually talking about his own limbs. And I got more and more intrigued by the reasoning. How was he reasoning? And how was he actually able to cope with that situation, that he had to give away all his people to save who in the end? In the end, there were only 788 people left of all these quarter of a million. So how did he reason? How did he think? And sometimes when I was reading about him, researching, he came through as your common megalomaniac, as you would say. At other times, I think he was obsessed by some sort of purity of vision. He actually saw that there was a light at the end of the tunnel, and this was the only feasible way to get there. But the one truth does not take out the other one. You can have these conflicting views and the conflicting viewpoints in the same person. And that's what makes him so fascinating. He was not only the chief collaborator of his town and this period, which he was, definitely, with the Nazis and what all the people he helped to kill, but he was also one of them, the persons who actively had a strategy to survive. It failed, but it did have a strategy. And that's what makes the portrait of him, I think, so moving. At least for me it was. You cannot stay with a cold heart when you look at him or read about him.
How far is his personality recoverable, do you think, from the historical record? And to what extent does the novelist's imagination, at what point does the novelist's imagination have to step in and really try to interpret what's there?
It's kind of an interesting question, because apart from the Ghetto Chronicle on which my book is based, there exists also parallel to that, and not as to this day published, something called the Ghetto Encyclopedia, which was in fact an encyclopedia that the same authors that wrote the Ghetto Chronicle put together themselves, because they knew that there were people, places, and things in the ghetto that were not actually comparable to anything else, and they made a list of those things. It was ways of expressions, the way the rations were dealt out, the way the police was organized in the ghetto, and such basic things. But it also was a list of the main personalities of the ghetto, their biographies, so to speak. And you have each and every one of the functionaries were there with detailed biographies, where they were born and educated, and their families, and so on and so on. So there's one card missing in that heap, and that is a card of Clyde Munkowski himself. There is no card on him, which seems extremely strange to us, or at least to me when I browsed through the encyclopedia for the first time. He was the chief, the main, the boss of the ghetto. Runkowski was the ghetto. So why wouldn't there be a card on him? And there are, of course, many, many reasons why. Maybe the card was extracted at some point. It was written. It did not please him. He took it out, or somebody else took it out. But it kind of describes also my method in my book. I mean, I try to get as close as possible to facts as I possibly can. I mean, I'm one of the few persons who actually have held this encyclopedia or have a copy of it in my own hands. And I've read each and every word of it. But I did also notice that the card of Runkowski was missing. So I kind of filled in my own card, if you can put it that way.
And then, so going on from him, you talked about walking the streets of Łódź and how comparatively unchanged they were. But how do you, as a novelist, go from that experience to actually bringing to life the everyday lot of people who were in that ghetto in those terrible years?
Yeah. Well, since there exists this huge compilation, this chronicle that was, actually, what it is a day-by-day account of what actually took place in the ghetto from the 20th of January 1941 up until the 30th of July 1944. That was actually the day before the last deportations began, and those who wrote the chronicle actually put on the trains, so they couldn't write anymore. So then you have 3,500 pages in which everything is listed. I mean, not only the main events, the deportations and everything, but also how do you deal with the coal distribution? How do you deal with the diseases? And who were actually queuing up for these and these things? There were three hens suddenly found running around in the ghetto. and it's just a vivid description of all the people, and they get running, trying to catch these two hens. And nobody knew where they flew from, but they were over a fence in some way, and they happened to be in together. And you can see from this vivid description of all together being on its feet, trying to catch these three hens. I mean, it kind of gives a different perspective of things. And let's get the Chronicles of Narrat as such. It's like a total story of a novel in a way. You're on each and every level of the ghetto society at the same time. So I kind of used that, and I used a lot of material from that. But it was also the ramp or the starting point for my own imagination. And it gave me the liberty to imagine these people as not as different from us as we would believe. They are their ordinary lives, although the circumstances were far from ordinary, but they had to live day by day, and how did they deal with that, and how did they feel, and so on. So the main characters of my novel is quite ordinary people trying to go about their daily lives.
And the book is told from the viewpoint of an omniscient third-person narrator, but it's not an impassive voice, and I wondered how you achieved that voice. Was it difficult to find the right pitch, the right tone for your narrative?
I think you should be keeping in mind a few things. The first thing is that this is a collective novel. It's really a novel about many people. So I made a decision not to have a main character, as you can say. There are many main characters, and you can follow the tracks of each and every one of them. But there is not a single individual with whom you would tend to empathize more than any other models. And I think that also gives very strict directives to the author. One thing that really kills in these circumstances is sentimentality. And sentimentality is that the author or the writer himself is trying to interpret events for the reader. He's telling the reader what to feel and when to feel and how to feel, which I think is just plainly wrong. And in this case, this Holocaust event, it's also morally wrong. Because you are the ones, the reader is the one who is presented with the actual events, and he is the one who is going to take these events in and also judge them according to his own. I'm not in favor of the kind of writing where the writer himself takes the reader by the hand and uses an entire book to show him, look at this, and this is, beware of this, and so on. I tend to look at my book as a recreation of a universe, a mental, social, political universe, extremely detailed. And the reader is let loose, so to speak, into that universe. And at some stage, he will discover, the reader too, that there are wolves around him too. And the important thing is that what will he feel, what will he do when he gets this?
And what's it like for you, Steve, growing in that universe? Because you must have lived in very close proximity to these events for some considerable time, both researching and then recreating it in fiction. So what kind of effects have you?
It's definitely difficult to say. Do I seem changed to you? I think for me it was extremely vivid. As I told you, I mean, to go back to the city was an imperative to me, and to actually walk the streets. I just did just recently, although the book is finished. And sort of come out in many languages. I say this is a place for me that's very, very close to me. And I think it was always the novel I felt I had it in me in some way to write. But I was not sure during the entire working process that I would be able to actually do it. There were so many things that seemed to be, to me, unfeasible, like I'm not Jewish myself. How would it be possible to put yourself into the mindset of somebody who's completely different roots and traditions and so on? But the only thing in the end you have to trust is your imagination. I did that, and I also had the opportunity to to use this astounding, fascinating document that the Chronicle is in itself. It's unique in the history of the Holocaust. And it was when I started writing the book, it was unpublished, and many parts of it are still unpublished. I think there will be now a homepage with the book where we will be able to publish some parts of the encyclopedia for the first time. So it's virgin ground in a way, and that I think kept me going. But I feel also that it's a book that really changed me in many ways, and I think and I hope that it will have the same, a little bit the same effect on the reader. I will be happy to.
And do you think writing about the Holocaust presents the novelist with particular responsibilities, or responsibilities in a particularly acute form?
Well, I've always seen my own work as a novelist as trying to get as close to the core moral issues as possible, and that goes also for the case in the case of Ronkowski. What really intrigues me is, of course, what is good, what is evil, the problems of good and evil, and you tend to think about good and evil as something that you can eat, you can choose. Like Barack Obama used to say, you're in for some hard choices. You can either go for the good, or you can either go for the bad, so to speak. But the fascinating thing is, in these kind of circumstances, there are no possibility to choose. I mean, evil is the lack of the possibility to choose. And Ronkowski was put in a place and in a set of circumstances where choice was taken from him. But he still had to make choices. He still had to do something. If he didn't act on the time, he would be destroyed. And this is kind of an extremely fascinating subject in its own right. Now it happened to be a Holocaust environment and so on, and that kind of puts a certain responsibility to you. But what interests me is not the particular time and place, but how do you feel when you have all this power? How does it change you? What are your nightmares when you wake up in a ghetto? You have said that you wanted to save, and you see that it's completely empty. So, of course, it puts a lot of responsibility on your shoulders, but I think you have to be true to facts, and you have to be true to your imagination and what you feel, like your inner compass as a writer. I think you should not go wrong.
And did your understanding of Ronkowski change? Did it deepen as you wrote the book? Did you discover things in the process of writing that weren't apparent when you began?
I think that my experience is that I thought he would come clear, so to speak. When I was finished with the book, when the book was finished, he would stand out, and I would suddenly be able to grasp him. But what happened was actually the opposite. The writing of him kind of kept putting layer and layer and layer on him, and it grew to be more and more complicated. He was, at least in my mind, he was not a very complicated person, I think. He was kind of extremely simplistic. He dealt with basic things. People were always quantifiable in his mind. He dealt with people like a businessman with his dry goods, so to speak. But then again, the way he delivered his speeches, his megalomania, his obsession with having this mission, and the way he constructed that mission as building some sort of protectorate for the Jews inside the borders of Europe, and so on. I mean, he was the most compromised person in any Polish Jewish society at that time, but he refused to bend. And he didn't he didn't bend to anybody. So you cannot add up the one paradox upon the other. And in the end, it comes out as quite a complicated character, but extremely fascinating.
Tell me, Steve, about the linguistic texture of the book, because you use words of German, of Polish, of Yiddish, and that's a very characteristic poem. You use songs and proverbs and little quotations. So tell me what you wanted to achieve through those means.
I think that an important thing for me when I wrote the book, and also the feeling I want to convey to those who read the book, that they are actually in a world. It's a world that's different from ours. but its world. And the most typical characteristic of this world is that it actually was a Babylon. Many of the Jews in Poland didn't even speak Polish. They spoke Yiddish. And that Yiddish was a special East European dialect of it that was not fully understandable even to other Jewish speakers. Then again, you had an aristocracy of Jews, you could say, who were bilingual, who spoke Polish, and tended to do that. But then again, there came a third wave of deputies from Berlin, Vienna, Prague. They were all German-speaking. So they landed in the ghetto speaking the same words, as a language as their oppressors. And they were always referred to as the Germans. Not the German Jews, but the Germans. In one of my characters in the book, Vera Schultz, who is a Czech Jew, she actually speaks German. And she brought along a small typewriter, not so small, but because she thought it could be useful, come in handy, so to speak. But it was completely impossible to use because the types were in a different language from the one that was commonly used. And she suddenly found herself in the street together with people she would never have known, who were talking a language she didn't understand, and she didn't have anything in common with. The only common thing was that they were considered by the Nazis to be Jews, and in that sense, exterminated. So I wanted, you tend to not think about this. You think about the camps, the ghettos, as some sort of homogeneous societies, but they were not. The only thing that made them homogeneous in that sense was that the Nazis wanted to exterminate them. And this is a way of giving them back their own voice. And see, okay, you have a multitude of society, you have London here in all its complexity. Okay, so how do you... So maybe that will change your way of looking at things.
I know that you translate yourself, and I wondered what it was like to see yourself down to another language, in this case, English. Mm. I mean, I think the translation is a very accomplished piece of work. I just wondered what it feels like to you to see your work in another language you understand.
I just want to say, first of all, that I completely agree with you. I was extremely lucky to have Sarah Duff as my translator, and she's an extremely dedicated and competent translator, and she's really made a huge work. Put in a huge amount of work to make this translation work, and it really does, as I've got the impression that it does. But of course, it's difficult to see your own thought and mind translated into different languages. It's also fascinating and intriguing. And you can see other shades and other things coming forward that were not as obvious to you in the first place when you wrote the book. Some less flattering, some more flattering, but it's interesting, and I think. But most of all, it depends on the translator. I mean, if you have a really good translator, as I had in this case, I think so. If I can be the judge of it at all, it can be. It can also make the book even more powerful, I think, in many ways.
The book is translated into something like 2,000 languages, and I wondered, in conclusion, perhaps, if you understand what is spoken to people, have some aspects of the reception book surprised you, or is it really achieving what you set out to in the way that you expected it to?
Well, the success of the book, if you can call it, use that word, it really surprised me. I was not aware at all that it would have this impact. Then again, it was a huge success, of course, in Sweden, but that of I mean, I've been writing a long time, and I'm quite well-known in Sweden, I would assume, so it could be a local phenomenon, if you put it that way. But it was really heartened me, and it's the fact that it has been so well-received, also in countries where I'm completely unknown entity, like, for example, here in Britain. It was also very well-received in Holland, came out just recently, and it's been through several print runs and so on, with extremely good reviews, and that makes me humble and grateful that it's considered to be a good read also when it appears in countries or in languages which are completely different from the Swedish where I wrote it. And that makes me glad and humble at the same time. And I really hope it can reach a British audience too.
And German edition in print yet?
It will come out soon. Everything is being prepared, and there's a lot of noise from that direction. We will see. Every country has a different reception. It will also be coming out in Poland, for example, which is extremely, I think, different from how it will be received here in Britain. And also there's a Hebrew translation slowly coming along, and that will also be interesting to see how it will be read in Israel. So there are many different kind of audiences. You can't please them all, of course, but I think that so far it's been okay. Thank you.
I was talking to Steve Sem Sandberg about The Emperor of Lies. It's available now in paperback. That's all for this edition of the Faber Podcast, but there are lots more interviews with Faber authors on the website at faber.co.uk/podcast. And if you've enjoyed this interview, do sign up for the monthly Faber Podcast by visiting iTunes and typing Faber in the search box in the podcast category. Until next time, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.